right now, your company's organizational chart is completely lying to you.
Oh, totally. It's a total fiction.
Right. Like, take a mental picture of that neat little pyramid hanging on the wall or, you know, sitting in your onboarding packet. You've got the CEO at the very top and all those solid, perfectly straight lines flowing downward to the VPs, the directors, the managers.
Right. It implies this flawless, orderly gravity.
Exactly. Like, information and strategy and commands just fall smoothly from the sky. But data shows that the most powerful person in your office right now probably doesn't have a title, doesn't manage a team, and, well, they might not even speak up in your weekly meetings.
Yeah, and that neat pyramid completely ignores the shadow network operating right underneath it. I mean, we've operated for decades under this comforting fiction that authority and influence are exactly the same thing.
Which they aren't.
Not at all. When you step inside a modern workplace, the reality of who actually moves the needle is completely invisible on that piece of paper. Gravity doesn't just flow down anymore, it flows sideways.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are unpacking a really fascinating transcript from the Now, Near, and the Future show, featuring Leo Bottery, who is a world-renowned expert on peer innovation.
It's such a great source text.
It really is. And our mission for you today is to decode the total collapse of that traditional top-down leadership model. We're going to explore why your peers, not your boss, hold the actual leverage in your career right now.
And, you know, because the timeline is accelerating way faster than anyone predicted, we're also going to look at how end-to-end artificial intelligence is about to fundamentally disrupt this entire horizontal dynamic.
It's wild. But to graph the magnitude of this shift, we first have to look at the macro context.
Yeah, we are living through an unprecedented crisis of trust. And the data here is just stunning. If you track the Edelman Trust Barometer over the last 25 years, you see this glaring societal fracture hit right around 2018.
Wow, 2018.
Yeah. We reached a tipping point where society at large couldn't even agree on a baseline set of facts. We kind of lost the collective understanding of who or what to actually believe.
And that societal fracture didn't just stay on the evening news. I mean, it walked right through the front doors of our offices.
It completely flooded the corporate ecosystem. By 2019, the data showed a fundamental behavioral shift in how employees process information. When an organization announced a major change, say a merger or, you know, a return to office mandate,
which everyone loves.
Right, exactly. Employees essentially stopped taking that corporate announcement at face value. Instead, they immediately turned to their coworkers to decipher it.
Think about the last time your company had a massive all-hands meeting. The CEO is on the screen delivering the official narrative, but what's actually happening?
It's like chats.
Yes. Your private Slack channels and text threads are absolutely lighting up. The boss has the megaphone, but your peers have the translation matrix.
That's a great way to put it.
The real truth of that initiative, whether people are going to actually buy in or just silently rebel, is being decided in real time in that horizontal chatter.
It's a massive transfer of power. And frankly, demographics are pouring gasoline on this fire. By 2030, millennials and Gen Z will make up roughly 75% of the global workforce.
75%.
Yeah. We are talking about generations that simply do not have a baseline trust in rigid, hierarchical authority.
Because they grew up in a completely different cultural paradigm. Like, if you look at the boomer generation, they were raised in what sociologists call power cultures.
Right.
You sat at the family dinner table, you didn't ask a lot of questions, and you did what you were told.
Right.
You then graduated into a corporate structure that operated exactly the same way. It wasn't designed to be a democracy.
No, not at all.
But this younger workforce, they grew up in environments where their parents constantly asked them, how do you feel about this? Let's talk it through. They are demanding that exact same constant dialogue and feedback loop inside the office.
Which leaves a lot of legacy executives completely paralyzed. I mean, they have 20-somethings walking into their offices wanting to co-create strategy, and the old command and control playbook is totally useless. The expectation has shifted from compliance to collaboration.
Okay, let's unpack this, because my immediate thought is a giant warning sign.
Uh-oh.
Well, if we remove the top-down directive, and everyone is just talking horizontally to achieve consensus, I'm struggling to see how anything actually gets done on a deadline.
Yeah, that's the fear.
Are we not just creating a massive corporate echo chamber where everyone nods in agreement to avoid conflict? It sounds like a recipe for the dreaded groupthink, where nobody wants to make the unpopular call.
That is the most common fear, and honestly, it's a valid one if a company doesn't understand the mechanical difference between thinking alike and thinking together.
Okay, what's the difference?
Thinking alike is exactly what you described. That's groupthink. Yeah. It happens when teams prioritize harmony over reality. People suppress their doubts just to keep the meeting moving.
Right.
Thinking together, however, is a deliberate, structured friction. It's about actively colliding diverse, even contradictory perspectives to stress test an idea until the best result survives.
But how does a manager actually execute that transition? Like, how do you force people to think together without just reverting to telling them what to do when the clock is ticking?
It requires a radical psychological pivot in how an organization handles accountability. Under the old dictatorship model, accountability was a weapon. You've heard the phrase, "I want one person accountable for this, so I have one throat to choke."
Ugh, yes. That's a terrible phrase.
It really is.
It's managing purely through the threat of punishment.
And it forces defensive behavior. If you know your throat is on the line, your primary goal isn't innovation. Your primary goal is covering your tracks. You hoard information and you point fingers. But progressive organizations are flipping this mechanism entirely. They are moving from fear-based accountability to belief-based responsibility. A leader sits down and says, "You have the reins on this project, not because I need someone to blame, but because we fundamentally believe in your capability. You matter to this team's success."
And here's where it gets really interesting, because that's not just corporate HR speak. That is biological.
Oh, the brain chemistry side of it.
Yeah. When a leader genuinely extends trust and autonomy, the employee's brain actually releases oxytocin, which drastically lowers their defensive threat response.
Wow.
Instead of trying to avoid the wrath of the boss, they suddenly feel a psychological ownership of the work. And because power is flowing sideways, peers start actively lifting each other up to ensure the collective succeeds.
But wait, if power is entirely horizontal now and influence matters more than titles, doesn't that just create a high school popularity contest? Who actually leads when there's no official boss dictating the terms?
That is the ultimate danger of informal influencers.
Right.
Because influence is just a mechanism. It's an amplifier. It doesn't care if the message is good or bad.
Right.
And the material introduces this brilliant categorization of the people wielding this invisible power. We have what are called ringleaders. If you walk into a room of executives and ask, "Who here has an employee with massive sway over the team, but absolutely no lofty title?" Every single hand shoots up.
Oh, yeah. If we connect this to the bigger picture, what's fascinating here is how we dissect the anatomy of that influence. You have to separate the helpful dissenters from the toxic ringleaders.
Okay, break that down.
A helpful dissenter is worth their weight in gold. They're the ones who look at your new strategic roadmap and say, this timeline is completely unrealistic and the software won't support it.
Which you need to hear.
Exactly. But the mechanism of their influence is collaborative. They highlight the problem, and then they grab a wrench, get in the room with you, and help rebuild the timeline.
Right, they actually have a vested interest in the survival of the project.
Which is exactly the opposite of the toxic ringleader.
Hmm.
The organizational terrorist.
The terrorist, yeah.
This is the person who leans back in their chair, crosses their arms, and operates entirely from the cheap seats. Their whole posture is, "Well, if I were running this place," while they continuously poke holes in every initiative without ever offering a solution or taking a risk themselves.
Well, I've worked with that person.
Yeah.
They hold the morale of the entire department hostage because people listen to them.
Always. And this brings us to a harsh but necessary philosophy from Gary Vaynerchuk that the source mentions. These toxic influencers cost companies an incalculable amount of friction and lost talent.
So what do you do with them?
Well, the hardest pill for management to swallow is that it fundamentally does not matter how high performing they are. That ringleader could be your absolute top salesperson bringing in millions.
Wow.
If they are poisoning the horizontal well, they must be aggressively coached to change their behavioral mechanics, or they have to be fired. Why? Because a culture is defined exclusively by what it tolerates.
We are what we tolerate. That is a total punch to the gut for any manager keeping a brilliant jerk on the payroll.
It's so true, though.
But let's look at the flip side. If you clear out the loud, toxic voices, you make room for what the source calls quiet leaders. These are the folks who don't have that dynamic, extroverted, table-pounding energy.
But when they finally do speak, the whole room stops to listen.
Exactly.
Their words carry immense gravity precisely because they aren't weighing in on every minor detail just to hear their own voice.
I picture them like the load-bearing walls in a house.
Yeah.
You don't immediately notice them the way you notice the flashy furniture or the loud paint colors, the extroverts. But if you remove them, the entire structure collapses under pressure.
That's a great analogy.
The problem is, how do you get a load-bearing wall to actually speak up in a chaotic meeting?
Well, you have to look at the mechanics of psychological safety. We often hear that term thrown around. Amy Edmondson, the Harvard scholar who coined it back in 1999, actually wrote the foreword for Baudry's book. Yeah, she defines it as a workplace that is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. But the crucial mechanism people miss is that passive safety is completely insufficient.
Meaning, you can't just slap a poster on the wall that says, safe space, and expect the introvert to suddenly grab the microphone.
No, it doesn't work because of how our brains are wired. For a quiet leader, speaking up in a room full of loud, confident peers triggers the amygdala. The brain registers the potential for social rejection as a literal physical threat.
The physical threat. That's intense.
So to overcome that biological barrier, the peers have to actively pass them the sheet music. It's the analogy of a jazz ensemble. Every person brings a specific genius. But if the trumpet player is quiet, the rest of the band doesn't just play louder to cover it up.
Right.
They create a physical space in the music, nod to the trumpet player, and invite them in. In a meeting, that looks like a peer turning across the table and saying, Sarah, we're spinning our wheels here, and I know you've looked deeply into the client data. What are we missing?
Oh, I love that. That direct, validating question acts as a neurological safety signal. You aren't just allowing them to speak. You are demanding their expertise because the group needs it.
Exactly.
But building that level of vulnerability and trust among peers is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
To understand how to actually manufacture it, we have to look at how top executives do it when the doors are locked.
This part is fascinating.
It really is. There is a wild insight regarding CEO peer advisory groups, networks like Vistage YPO or REREF. When you put a dozen highly successful CEOs in a private room, 80% of them find it significantly easier to share deeply personal family issues than to share their business struggles.
Which completely defies logic. I mean, these are explicitly designed as business advisory groups, yet they'd rather talk about their marriages than their balance sheets.
It's because of the currency of the room. When you are a CEO, your entire identity is wrapped up in being the smartest person in the room. If you admit to a table of other high-powered executives that your supply chain is a disaster or, you know, you made a catastrophic hiring error, you risk bankrupting that intellectual currency. You risk looking weak.
They are fiercely protecting the illusion of competence.
Yes. So facilitators use an exercise to forcefully dismantle that ego, and the psychology behind it is brilliant. It's called the biggest mistake exercise.
Oh, I've heard of this.
So the facilitator asks one CEO to look the group in the eye and share the single biggest professional disaster they've ever caused. Someone sheepishly raises their hand, admits they blew a $1 million deal, and physically braces for the judgment.
But the opposite happens.
The opposite happens. The tension breaks, and two seats down, someone says, oh, you think that's bad? Let me tell you how I almost bankrupted my company in 2018.
It instantly escalates into a race to the bottom. It becomes a contest of who failed harder.
Exactly. The people who went first actually get mad because they want a second turn to tell a worse story. It completely shatters what we can call the LinkedIn highlight reel.
Oh, the highlight reel.
We all walk around in this corporate hallucination where everyone's highlight reel is running 24/7. Everyone is absolutely crushing their KPIs all the time.
Mm.
But in that room, when the highlight reel is turned off, they realize real horizontal power doesn't come from projecting flawlessness.
And the mechanism at play here is human gap filling. When we don't have all the information about what someone else is thinking, human beings are incredibly impatient. We immediately fill the silence with our own internal narratives, and because of our own insecurities, we usually assume the other person is judging us.
Oh, yes.
By forcing shared vulnerability, you short-circuit those false narratives. You prove that everyone is dealing with the exact same chaos. It trains leaders to stop jumping to conclusions, to lean into curiosity, and to ask precise questions.
And when they take that modeled behavior back to their teams, the peer pressure to be excellent completely takes over. There's a great story about Baudry's early career at the MullenLowe agency.
Oh, I remember this.
He walked into his first major pitch meeting, and he saw the insane, meticulous level of preparation his peers had brought to the table. He didn't need a manager to pull him aside and put him on a PIP, you know, a performance improvement plan.
Right.
Seeing in the standard of his peers gave him a welcome to the NFL moment. Our myriad neurons are incredibly powerful. When you put a human in a high-performing pack, their biological drive is to elevate their game to survive in that pack. Peer pressure, when channeled correctly, drives excellence far better than any boss ever could.
But, and this is a big prestard, but consider the alternative reality rapidly approaching us. We've established how humans elevate each other through empathy, shared struggle, and horizontal influence. But the timeline is shifting.
The AI piece.
Yeah. There is a new peer entering the workforce, and it fundamentally alters this entire biological equation.
Because by early 2026, which is practically tomorrow in corporate planning cycles, we are projected to see end-to-end agentic AI systems beginning to hollow out and replace traditional middle management.
Let's clarify that term because it's vital. We aren't talking about a chatbot where you type a prompt and get a paragraph back.
Right, no.
Agentic AI refers to autonomous systems that can be given a complex multi-step goal, and they will go out, execute the steps, correct their own errors, and manage a process over weeks or months without human intervention.
So the human roles will shift from doing the rote execution to overseeing the AI's processes. But here is the massive paradigm shift. We aren't just getting AI as a tool. We are getting AI as a horizontal peer.
And this brings up the raw power of synthetic synthesis. Baudry is already experimenting with this, using tools like Google's Notebook LM. He took roughly 500 pages of dense academic research Canadian studies on workplace stress and American Psychological Association data on employee wellness.
That's a lot of reading.
Right. He fed all of those hundreds of pages into the AI alongside the entire manuscript of his own book on peer innovation.
A human researcher would need weeks just to read that, let alone cross-reference the methodologies.
And the AI processed it in seconds.
Yeah.
But here is the kicker. It didn't just summarize the data. It uncovered a deeply hidden correlation. It proved that the exact same peer innovation practices designed to ruthlessly drive corporate productivity paradoxically reduce workplace anxiety.
Oh, wow.
Usually, those two things are inversely correlated, pushing productivity spikes burnout. But the AI mapped how peer accountability actually aligns them. It synthesized mountains of data into a net new insight instantly.
It gets even more surreal.
Hmm.
Baudry has an AI podcast set up on LinkedIn featuring two artificial personas named Dwayne and Jane.
Oh, right.
He feeds his written CEO World articles into this system, and the AI agents generate a 12 to 16 minute audio discussion. But Dwayne and Jane aren't just reciting his text, they're riffing off each other, connecting his article to broader economic trends and uncovering insights that the author himself didn't even write.
Crazy.
He is literally learning new perspectives on his own brainchild from his artificial peers. So what does this all mean? If an AI can synthesize 500,000 pages in 5 seconds, find correlations we missed, and autonomously manage projects, are human peers going to become totally obsolete in this new horizontal structure?
Well, this raises the ultimate anxiety of the modern knowledge worker. But there is massive limitation to the algorithm, which is perfectly illustrated by an experiment from the MIT Sloan Management Review.
Okay, tell me about this.
Researchers used generative AI to create the ultimate virtual peer advisory group. Imagine waking up at 2 a.m. sweating over a supply chain crisis, and you can instantly summon a digital brain trust featuring the simulated personas of Sun Tzu, Buddha, Steve Jobs, and Oprah Winfrey.
That is the most intimidating late-night Zoom call in history.
Right. It's an unparalleled resource for rapid brainstorming. But the researchers conclude that human beings bring a vital mechanism to the table that AI simply lacks the physical lived reality check. Without human guardrails, AI operates entirely on algorithmic logic, which inevitably produces what we can call the salt and vinegar donut.
The salt and vinegar donut. I love this. Explain the mechanics of this pastry to me.
Okay, so if you ask an AI to design a highly profitable new snack food, it looks at the data purely logically. Data point A, consumer purchasing habits show humans devour massive amounts of salt.
Sure.
Data point B, humans buy a ton of vinegar-flavored products. Data point C, humans spend billions on donuts. So the algorithmic logic is flawless. Combine the three most popular items, and a salt and vinegar donut will mathematically dominate the market.
But any human being with a gastrointestinal tract looks at that recipe and instantly gags.
Precisely. The AI doesn't have a body. It doesn't understand nausea, fatigue, or nuance. It makes perfect logical sense to a machine, but it is a catastrophic human experience.
That's true.
That is why humans are not obsolete. As these agentic systems completely take over the middle layers of corporate execution, The market premium on human judgment, emotional context, and lived experience is going to absolutely skyrocket.
Humans are the only defense against the salt and vinegar donuts of the corporate world.
Exactly.
Well, let's pull all these threads together. We've navigated a monumental rewiring of the corporate ecosystem today. We've watched the death of the top-down dictator, brought down by a societal loss of trust and a generational demand to be heard.
Yep.
We've seen that in a world of horizontal gravity, you must fiercely protect your culture by neutralizing the organizational terrorists in the cheap seats while actively passing the sheet music to your quiet, load-bearing leaders. We've pierced the illusion of the CEO highlight reel, discovering that true influence requires the extreme vulnerability to admit what you don't know.
It's a huge shift.
And we've stared down the barrel of 2026, preparing for a reality where agentic AI sits right next to us in the brainstorming room.
And if we distill this down, your survival in this new landscape relies on a shift in your personal skill set. In an era defined by overwhelming information, flattened orb charts, and hyper-intelligent AI, your greatest asset is no longer your technical ability to execute tasks.
The AI will do that faster and better.
Exactly. Your true assets are your genuine curiosity, your willingness to put your ego aside to ask the precise, illuminating question, and your ability to anchor your team in shared human reality. That emotional translation is what cannot be automated.
Which leaves us with a final, slightly unsettling implication to mull over. We know that human peer pressure can elevate your game to an NFL level purely through mirror neurons and the desire to keep up with the pack.
Right.
But if agentic AI becomes your most reliable, flawless peer by 2026, doing the heavy lifting, the synthesis, and the prep work perfectly every single time, what happens to the people at the very top?
That's the big question.
If the algorithm is doing all the flawless business logic, will the corporate leaders of the 2030s even be selected for their business acumen? Or are we about to enter the era of the therapist CEO? A future where the person at the top of that org chart isn't an MBA, but a sociologist or a psychologist, someone selected entirely for their deep emotional empathy, because that will literally be the only scarcity left in the building.
Wow.
Something to think about the next time you look at the names on your company's org chart.